Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. Today, my special guest is Krish Raval. Krish is a great friend. I've worked with Krish in his faith and leadership programs. Krish is director and founder of Faith and Leadership. It's Britain's main leadership development organization, which works with clerical and lay leaders from different faith communities. Interestingly, Krish is a Hindu and works mainly with Christian, Jewish, and Muslim leaders. Krish has had an amazing experience. He's met some icons of leadership, including Mother Teresa, Nelson Mandela, and the Dalai Lama. And he has recently received an OBE for his services to leadership in education and interfaith. Krish, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thank you, Simon. Pleasure to talk to an old friend. So, and I'm slightly intimidated by the array of people you've had on these previous podcasts. So I hope I, you know, match the, or at least come close to their brilliance.
Well, you have a very interesting story to tell, Krish. So you were born in Ethiopia, is that right?
Yeah, so I was born in Ethiopia. I was the third generation of my family to be born there. And in the 70s, when the Mengistu regime took over from Haile Selassie, we had to escape under gunfire. So I found myself living in the lap of luxury as this absolute spoilt little kid in Ethiopia as part of an empowered minority. And overnight, it seemed that we were in a 1.5-bedroomed shared accommodation in North London in the freezing London winter, and very much a part of a disempowered minority. So that really affected me. Yeah,
and your family made good though. They worked hard. Your father and your parents, and they, who I've met, they're wonderful people.
Yeah. So that's right. So, but that's the, but that experience of being an immigrant really has shaped much of my thinking of because we were so established, and Dad was so established, as I say, he had his businesses and all sorts of things, and at the age of 45 just lost everything,
Wow.
And started again here. Yeah, they remember you, so they're actually stuck in India right now, stranded because of COVID, longing to meet their granddaughter. So again, yeah.
So. And you've been interested in leadership from a young age. And so tell me how you got into faith in leadership.
Yeah, so the defining experience of my life, I guess, was when we talked about coming to Britain. I did really badly at school. And it wasn't because I was bright. It was because of just me being a daydreamer, not knowing how to express myself. And I was about to be excluded or, you know, failing all my GCSEs and all the rest. And I got a mentor who was opposite, you know, very different from me. He was a white working class guy, but a Christian who'd worked in the UN and other things. So came from a working class background, and he took me under his wing. And the confidence I received in getting that mentorship meant that I could go to Cambridge University. And that, of course, changed my life. And just a realization that there are loads and loads and loads and loads of really talented, bright young people, existing in remedial classes whose potential hasn't been released, is something that interests me. And I found leadership as a way of doing that. I didn't know at the time this was leadership, but leadership at that time very simplistically meant that I would develop myself in order to help others. And then I really saw this gap. As somebody who's practicing Hindu, I saw this gap in society here that we don't really talk about faith, or if we do, we're embarrassed by it. Yet faith influences so many people and so much. And the resources, so as a as a corporate consultant and leadership and a lawyer, I saw the leadership resources that were directed at me, and I directed at, you know, other people. But the faith communities that are really on the cutting edge of provision in society, providing, you know, social services, reconciliation work, you know, dealing with the homeless, goodness knows what else, they weren't really given resources to develop their faith, you know, their faith services to develop their leadership. So I decided to, you know, provide something to address that need. But what I remember is that I started something called Faith in Leadership in 2007. And shortly after, you independently ran a conference called Faith in Leadership, just independently at the Tavistock Clinic. And that's right, where we met, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, my interest, I'm similar background, you know, I kind of was one of those lost children at school, and I didn't get my O levels, and I scraped my way into nursing kind of after working in a factory, and ended up getting educated later on. But also developed an interest in faith later on, although it's interesting that even though I was mainly kind of, all my friends were secular, they still laugh at me whenever I go anywhere. I'm in the nearest cathedral, the nearest mosque, the nearest kind of Krishna temple, whatever it is, I'm there, you know, or in nature, and very drawn to the spiritual side of life. And yet we live in Britain in a very secular world, feels very, very secular.
Yeah, it is very secular. And I think, I mean, let's be clear, I'm not about, you know, making Britain a theocracy or anything like that. I think that faith flourishes in a fair secular society. So I'm for the secular society, but one that is fair.
Yeah.
And so part of our theory of change is to normalize intelligent faith in the public square. Partly because there are such amazing resources. And, you know, you've taught on our programs. You see the quality of people who, you know, we curate and who kind of underpin our faith traditions. I mean, some of the brightest, intelligent, connected, happy, talented. I don't know if I said that word again, but, you know, just the best people.
Amazing,
have our faith communities. And it's a real privilege to get them to meet each other and kind of riff off each other.
It's an amazing experience. I mean, I've taught on the program two or three times, and each time completely inspired. And I remember last time some Muslim women leaders stood out, and they were just like inspirational, really, what they were doing and how they were taking on roles. And it's a part of society we don't see very often, you know, in mainstream societies. It's not visible.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because religiosity in the world is growing as the uncertainty grows, I guess. Yet in Britain, we've become more and more and more sort of intolerant of anyone expressing what their inner beliefs are. And often, you know, to the people who don't have a high threshold of tolerance for people of faith, I often ask them, well, have you met somebody of the same intelligence as you who comes from a faith tradition, somebody with who has done, and you know, done amazing things in society, but they're just quiet about it because they don't show off. And when we've done that, often we have you know, bridges are built. But you know, the leaders of society, so many of them, so, you know, we worked with you know, Mary McAleese, you're in Ireland, the former president of Ireland, Rajmohan Gandhi, the grandson of the Mahatma, obviously the Archbishop of Canterbury, the chief rabbi, the cardinal, all these people have been, you know, part of our thinking and part of our patron body. You know, they've given the go-ahead for our programs, and we've got around 300 alumni who've been trained intensively, and about 3,000 to 4,000 people who've been on our kind of ad hoc programs. That so we're the only organization that is trusted by, you know, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian organizations to work within their own communities
And
across their communities, with the same people. So what we've just been doing really is brokering relationships, and these have come into their own whenever we have had a public celebration, royal weddings or, football victories or things like that, but also disasters. And you really do realize that these are people who do bring our society together. They're the glue that keeps Britain. And you've worked with, the Church of England and all sorts of faith communities.
Yeah, I've taught in theology schools and different faith communities. And as you know, I'm a Quaker and aligned to the Church of Ireland at the moment, but always found myself in the East London Mosque when I was when I lived in East of London. And as you know, Soho Krishna Temple is a favourite spot. So kind of into interfaith thinking and other religions. Very interesting what it means for you to be a Hindu working with these three faiths.
So I also work with the Hindu and Sikh communities, and we have a young people's program that embraces, that's for everyone. But there is a particular dysfunction or a particular relationship between the Jews, Muslims, and Christians, the historical one, which means when we get people together, it's, they kind of riff off the same kind of source materials often, or the same references. So, if you work with Hindus, and you've got a scriptural passage from the Bible, a Hindu may well say, well, who's Abraham? Well, that issue just doesn't arise when you're working with the Abrahamic faiths. So it's fine, because I'm just kind of neutral. They all see me as kind of their own, and they're very kind to me. And now I've got a reputation, so for being a friend of, just being trusted, and that's really important. But the thing that I come across as within the faith field is the leadership guy, not so much a theologian. We get theologians, our program is based on scriptural reasoning and the principle of disagreeing well. And part of our theory of change is that, it's okay to disagree. You just have to disagree well. And we get source materials, so scriptural passages on a given theme, and we interrogate them and go deep in our discussions and disagreements on them. And what I find is that the more centered you are in your faith, the more you are actually, and the more secure you are within the in your faith, the more respect you give to your equivalents from the other faith. And you actually realize things about your own scripture because you've kind of listened to another perspective on it that you just haven't seen before. And that happens all the time. And also historically, we look at a passage and it's sometimes removing to think that nobody's ever, no Jew, Muslim or Christian has ever looked at this particular passage in this way. Ever before. And these materials have been there around for thousands of years. So that's one aspect of what we do. And the other aspect is leadership skills and where your discourses are really, really influential. I wonder though, because what we do is so in keeping with your ideas on eco-leadership, because the assumption behind what we do is that to have a flourishing society, you ignore the other at your own expense. And so to make the best of the opportunities presented to us as a society, we need to work together. And we have loads of examples of how friendships between imams and rabbis and vicars, for instance, have led to all sorts of generative things in communities. But this idea that we can't do it all together, we need each other, even if you're different, is very much a eco-leadership concept, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the deeper I go into this work, I've been writing about eco-leadership since maybe 2005 or 2007. And it was seen as very marginal then. And increasingly it's seen as kind of more mainstream, whether I'm working with a corporate bank or whether I'm working with the health sector or in a recently the Catholic Church have been in touch, and I'm working with them, and they all realize that you can't live in this isolation anymore. You can't live in a closed system. We're all absolutely connected and absolutely interdependent, which is very deep into the Hindu tradition. Mm. And it's, it's very present, and people absolutely get it. It's like, you know, the pandemic again shines a light on this. You know, all the four discourses of leadership are needed in the pandemic. So eco-leadership doesn't say you can't any longer have controller leadership or therapist leadership or messiah leadership, the other three discourses. It says they're all necessary in balance. You know, so we need lockdown at certain times. We need to understand the numbers, the data. We need controller leadership in the pandemic. We need therapist leaders who can be caring, who can communicate well, who can look after people. We need messiah leadership where we can have some vision for the future. Where do we go from here, you know? And we need eco-leadership to think about how all these things are interconnected, you know, how the public health system works with the education system, works with the economy, how we work internationally, how we work across communities. And we've seen some great examples of it, but it's just very alive in society today that this is absolutely necessary. And in the faith world, again, like people who isolate themselves hermetically will struggle and do struggle.
Yeah, I'm part of our theory of change again, because we've got a long theory of change, but part of it is about helping people, faith leaders, to exist outside of their own echo chambers. It's so important. So do you think that we could, like the faith communities could be real ambassadors for this movement that you've unleashed on eco-leadership? And if so, how? I mean, can we think about that? That how we could really help. We're natural allies, right? So
absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, I'm setting up an eco-leadership institute at the moment, and I want to kind of partner with faith and leadership to work in this domain, because I think this crossover. What you're doing with interfaith leaders is absolutely vital, but also between faith and secular leadership, I think these links need to be kind of much much stronger. There's a lot of people desperately searching for meaning. There's a lot of organizations searching for social purpose rather than just for profit. There's a lot of people becoming aware of their social values and ethics and the environmental trouble. There is quite a big shift going on, I think, at all levels. And I think faith in leadership and the work you've done has a crossover and needs to be shared, and vice versa. I think secular leadership studies can actually help the faith leaders as well. So I think there's this cross-fertilization of learning which needs to take place.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are a number of ways. I mean, I agree with that. And I'd love to support that vision, because, I mean, you're right. Like, if we could start with COVID, I mean, it was a cliche, but, you know, we can't protect ourselves, that, you know, in the sense that from or isolate ourselves fully from the stuff happening in India or from stuff happening in, you know, some other remote corner of the world. We are as affected by our neighbor as we ever have been. Well, the faiths have been teaching this for centuries, but now it's coming into kind of mainstream awareness. And your idea of you know, abiding or respecting the laws of nature and not being, you know, not succumbing to the 21st or the 20th century fantasy that we have conquered nature. I mean, again, that is entirely consistent with Hindu thought. And as it happens, the thinking about, you know, diet, food, how to eat, vegetation, that exists in Judaism and Islam and in Christianity. So yeah, natural bedfellows, natural allies.
Yeah, and as in the secular world where you get distorted leadership and shadow side, you get in the faith world and religious world, and you know, whilst the faith teach love and peace and harmony, there's conflict and there's always stresses. I mean, I'm sure you're dealing with a lot at the moment with the Israeli situation with the leaders you're dealing with. It must be quite difficult.
Emphatically so. And I one of my kind of ways of surviving is to not be drawn in, but to provide a neutral platform, often over meals, where people on different sides of propositions can kind of talk in a safe space about things that they wouldn't ordinarily be able to talk about. So yeah, so we're doing that all the time. The fallout from not just Israel-Palestine as vital as it is, but a number of other conflicts, whether it's, you know, racism in one of the political parties or how faith can be seen to play its part in government policy to freedom of religion and belief. I mean, our alumni are involved in all of that, and we just happen to be able to be a neutral convener of so many of the discussions. I mean, is it worth my telling you just a little bit about how we do what we do and then just tell you about our plans? Because I think they kind of might fit in with your ideas for the Institute. It'd just be nice to.
Yeah, no, I think the audience would really like to hear kind of what you're doing and it's.
Yeah, so we have a number of programs. The senior, I'll just talk about three of them. The Senior Faith in Leadership program takes five or six Muslims, five or six Christians who are known for their leadership within their respective communities and brings them together in a three-module, three-day residential program that spread over the year at Windsor Castle. So we're very grateful to the Queen for allowing us to use the castle. And the reason why, I mean, we started off using like the village halls and things like that, you know, in Northwest London and inner city Sheffield and elsewhere. But I love Windsor Castle because the place in the castle that we're at is kind of isolated. And there are soldiers who patrol it. So if anyone wants to escape, they can't easily, you know, and you can't go in without security passes. And so we get people there and they kind of think, oh my goodness, what have I got myself into? Because part of the, I must admit, so I didn't come to this from an interfaith perspective. Actually, most of the interfaith I had experienced was dreadful, absolutely dreadful. It, like, to me, it drove people apart. More than bring them together. That's just me. I'm not saying all interfaith is like that, but that's what I had experienced. So we just said we were a leadership program for faith leaders, and why discriminate in favor or against any faith leader? We just said we'll have Jews, Muslims, Christians, because they're the majority, you know. And it's only when we came across the work of Professor David Ford at the Divinity School at Cambridge University that we really understood that actually good interfaith is about, as I say, disagreeing well and bringing your whole self to the table, yet understanding that actually, you know, the task is to love the other in full view of your difference within certain shared parameters. So based on that, we have 9 amazing days and we do everything from looking and interrogating scripture to simulating conflict and kind of getting these kind of holy, pious faith people really hot and bothered and kind of filming them and allowing them to see what they're like. I mean, you know, you talked about the fallout from the Israel-Palestine situation. Now, the number of faith leaders that I work with who have been, what's the word, when the press do set you up and they kind of entrap you by, there's a particular word for it. But anyway, the 3 or 4 people from different faith communities have been trapped by the press and have been secretly recorded saying things that they wouldn't ordinarily say. And actually they don't mean, but in the heat of the moment, they've said something offensive, could be offensive to another faith community. So how do you deal with people who have said that and now deeply regret it? We've been working with people and say, well, is this what you really think? And, you know, so you have one person from one faith who has considerable standing in that faith, who's offended, said offensive things about people from another faith. What do you do? Do you just leave that person to forever be like that? Or do you bring that person and the resources that that person has, the influence that person has, into fellowship with similar people from other faiths who've said similar things? And these are kind of relationships we're brokering right now. But on the program, we just build relationships of trust, really, as a result. And when I say we build them, we allow participants to build them. And we have certain rules and certain preconditions for allowing that to happen. And, you know, we have stellar speakers coming in. But the real thing is it's a process and people change as a result of these 9 to 12 days, which are really, really intensive. And it feels like it's a real year's worth of brushing up against the other. So then we do have a similar program for younger people, but then we have an alumni program where we look at the science of dialogue, where we look at, you know, we would love to look at eco-leadership more deeply. We look at different, you know, unconscious bias, racism, some of the critical race theory. All these things we provide opportunity, scripture and violence. You know, so many things we provide resources to take our alumni to the next stage. Now many of them are becoming bishops or the equivalents. And if we continue in this way, surely, you know, the leaders of the people at the very pinnacle of the faith communities will have come through our stable, knowing one another. So that's where we are now. Where we want to get to is we want to resource a number of our faith leaders, our alumni, to host discussions, like difficult discussions up and down the country on intractable conflicts. And we want them to be skilled into doing that. And we want to kind of unleash a whole program of radical hospitality. Mm-hmm. So there'll be meals, and meals are not just, you know, you come and eat. You have to be very attentive to the dietary needs of other faith communities. Yes. So, you know, Muslims will not enjoy being on the table with where alcohol is served. You know, some Jews won't feel comfortable if food isn't kosher. So, you know, these little things really, really matter.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're going to launch a program of radical hospitality in homes and faith centers across the country. And it's our way of bringing people together. And that is accompanied by all sorts of training and all sorts of areas of leadership.
Yeah, well, I love this idea. I mean, it really fits with kind of, it puts into practice what I kind of write about and what I try to encourage in terms of eco-leadership, because I talk about leadership formation rather than kind of leadership development or training. And I talk about creating leadership spaces. So it's exactly how you described it. You know, you create a space, you offer some text, you offer some food for people to kind of digest. But really the work is to allow leadership to emerge, to our relationships to develop, to learn from each other, to experience each other face to face. And it produces something magical. It produces something very, very different, which you can't teach in a classroom. And then you're creating these networks, you know, these networks which quietly are doing their work in the communities, quietly doing their work between faith, you know, challenging situations, creating dialogues, you know. And this kind of network involvement is how change really takes place, I think. You know, this does change the way people kind of experience each other and the way they take up leadership and followership and the way they influence society. So it's great work, Chris, really. And it's exciting work and it's very needed. Yeah.
Thanks. And we're looking at immigration and the refugee crisis, particularly right now. But the environment is, to one of our guys is now the head of faith and religion at the UN, so which is amazing. He came as a kid, yeah. Like 15 yeah. years ago, on one of our programs, Hindu guy, and now he's in this position at the UN working with Al Gore and goodness knows who else. So there are all sorts of people like that trust people that they wouldn't have otherwise met, you know, in yeah. life had they not been on our program, and have kind of continued dialogue with them. I don't think we've taken advantage of the web environment, the digital environment enough. And that's also something that we're looking to do. But you're right, we've got networks of trust is what we're all about. Yeah.
Yeah, relationships and networks of trust. And that idea of allowing leadership to emerge, I mean, I'm constantly telling organizations and people I work with, you know, you have to create spaces to allow leadership to emerge. And people kind of talk to me about, is eco-leadership some utopian idea, and can you distribute leadership? Is it possible? And I'm like, it's there anyway. It's like, it's there anyway, you know? Honestly, it's there. Just look for it. Look differently. Allow it to emerge. You know, allow this talent to bubble through and you'll find it. You know, it's not kind of something you have to kind of put into people. It's there. It kind of needs kind of enabling.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what we do. The leaders are there. The pluralism is there. The question is, can we create a healthy pluralism? So we've got pluralism, whether we like it or not. Is it healthy? Mm. We've got leadership whether we like it or not, but is it healthy? And one of, as I say, you have proved that, you know, we need the interdependence means that, you know, it will be healthy if leaders can riff off one another and build on each other's ideas and actually support each other. And actually, you know, on a very basic and kind of crude level, a imam who whose congregation goes and he has to like pile up all the chairs in his hall, I mean, faces his brother in Christianity in the vicar who has is faced with the same problem, and a rabbi who's faced with the same problem too. So they've got all sorts of things in common, yet they haven't really up to now sufficiently kind of helped one another. And that's just in this narrow faith field, let alone in terms of what they have to offer the rest of society. And, you know, in terms of mental health provision, which I know is close to your heart, I mean, the role that faith communities have been playing, just, I mean, our alumni have been playing in homes up and down the country during this pandemic is like huge. And the government's only beginning to realize how much of a partner it has got in the faith community, just in this regard. So we're living in an interdependent age, and faith communities just need to be on the table, and you'll see that, you know, the talents that the communities have can be unleashed for the greater good. Is there an interest in spirituality, I wonder, and faith leadership within the private sector, or is it still kind of taboo? When I used to work as a lawyer in Los Angeles for my law firm, it was just completely, you know, you couldn't mention it. Maybe it's different now, but mindfulness is the thing that I note in my old law firm that has just gone through the roof.
It shows up differently in different cultures, and I work internationally. So, you know, in America, there's still probably about 50% Christian membership. So it's much different to Europe, and it's visible there in different, you know, in the Middle East and in different kind of parts of the world. You know, it's just still a big part of the culture. But generally, I mean, what I find in corporates is there's an absolute desire and need and hunger for meaning and spirituality. And people often try and find it through mindfulness or some spirituality, which they divorce from religion. It's sort of religion bad, spirituality good. You know, it's kind of the language. Sadly, a lot of it gets instrumentalized. I get troubled talking about spirituality in the workplace because people often sort of instrumentalize it and say, you know, do mindfulness and it'll make you kind of make your workforce kind of even more productive. You know, well, great. Yeah. You know? And then they can even burn out faster than they can do more mindfulness, you know, to repair themselves. And you get into that kind of a way of thinking. And I'm really, I don't like the idea that, you know, there's people writing about spiritual intelligence and kind of, it's very instrumental in like, you know, that it can make you more profit. It can make you a better performer. Whereas I think spirituality and faith is something beyond productivity. I mean, it has to give us a different lens into kind of our own lives and our relationships and the world around us. But it's definitely there. And I think if people can experience healthy faith leadership and healthy faith engagement rather than what they see as, you know, the bad press, you know, the interfighting between kind of religions or some dogmatic kind of religious practices, which, you know, they see, I think there's a big space for people to kind of engage, but there's a lot of work to be done. That's why I'd like to work with you to really kind of start building those bridges, and people can see. People don't have experience of good faith.
No. And that's partly because the good people from the worlds of leadership and, you know, other worlds that we know kind of ignore faith. So we have bad leaders. So, you know, there's a number of things that I would love to say to you. I mean, one is that, you know, we have in this country just one community, the Muslim community, about 3.5 million Muslims right now. That's within, I think that's in 4 years, when I, you know, looked at it 4 years ago, we had 1.5 million or 2 million. So it's almost doubled, more than doubled. And within another 7-8 years, we're going to have a conservative estimate, 8 to 9 million Muslims, and this is going to increase more. Now, the structures within the Muslim communities too, so there's huge talent within the Muslim communities for everyone. Yeah. The structures that exist within the Muslim communities for leadership aren't really sufficient to bear this load. And so you have all sorts of wonderful leaders existing, but they're not being corralled, they're not being introduced to their contemporaries from other backgrounds. And who loses out? Well, clearly the Muslim communities do, but the rest of us do, because this is if we're just fair and objective about it, this is an important transition that is existing within our society. So there's just one example. So we're putting a lot of effort into resourcing kind of younger people, not just to lead Muslims, but to lead everyone. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think eco-leadership comes into its own. And I remember, I'm just hopping around a bit, but I remember you kindly mentioned in the introduction that, you know, part of my kind of training was to interview some of the icons of leadership. And one of them was Nelson Mandela. And I was with him when he said, you know, I'd be there. And he pointed to his left. And, you know, and when he points, he's got a long finger. And on his left was Robben Island. Mm-hmm. I'd still be there if it wasn't for the African traditionalists, the Christians, the Muslims, the Buddhists, the Hindus, others. And that really proved to me the power of faith to mobilize people, but also see them through change. So religion may not be about productivity as much as it is about kind of helping you as a person to understand change, but helping communities also mobilize people in ways of virtuous change, I guess. So it's a vital phenomenon, and I don't understand why we don't look at it more. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting how at one level people sort of debunked religion or faith and said it's not scientific enough and we need to be more rational, and they kind of went down that path. And now we live in a world of kind of fake news.
Yeah.
One of the most irrational kind of spaces one can imagine with the internet. And
So, you know, our institute in Oxford is on the same road as Dawkins, which I just really look forward to bumping into him one day, inviting him for a cup of tea with some Vickers or something. But he always says, you know, I'm interested in the truth. And so am I, actually. But one truth is that loads and loads and loads of people are influenced by this thing called faith.
Yeah.
And really, if we're going to change society, to ignore this vast phenomenon is really, really important. But we were talking about leadership and change, and your book you wrote during a period of real change and transition for you, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's partly why, I mean, it's called Leadership a Critical, is it a critical text?
Yeah, Leadership a Critical Text.
Which is, if I may say so, kind of not representative of the depth of the power of the book, because it's not dry. It's got real depth, and that's partly because of the circumstances in which you wrote it. You wrote it in a monastery.
Yeah, I finished it in a monastery. I mean, it came from my PhD work, but the title was, as they said when they gave me the title, they said, you know, that's its kind of slot, its place, but it would never sell very well, Simon, because of the title.
Right.
I was condemned to not have a kind of a best-selling book from the beginning.
You called it Leadership, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll or something. Then.
Yeah, that's right. I need to bring it to life. Yeah. But yeah, no, I finished it. I was in studying theology in Berkeley. I left Lancaster Management School, and I was thinking about divinity and what to do with my life. And I kind of I went walkabout basically, and I left the theology college after 3 months, and I went traveling, and it was so interesting because I didn't have any plans, but I saw this sign saying Hermitage, and I thought, interesting. So I drove up this mountain path in the Big Sur, absolutely beautiful part of the USA, like amazing trees and Pacific Ocean. And at the top of this this mountain was a hermitage, a Kamal Dalis hermitage. And I slept outside of my tent, and the one of the monks came out in the morning and invited me in. And I spent, I think it was 2 weeks with them in a caravan in their grounds. And it was just inspiring and just a rhythm of life, the beauty of nature and the ritualistic prayer. And just learning with observing the monastery, it taught me about leadership formation rather than kind of, I looked at the monks and I kind of thought, you don't train to be a monk by learning monk skills. You train to be a monk by being formed by your experience. You know, you experience a ritual prayer, you experience spiritual direction, you experience kind of the communal life. You have to work with your hands to make your bread. It's all that together kind of forms the monk. And each monk has a specific charism, a specific gift, you know, a very particular gift from God to give to the world. And that's very particular. And I thought this is absolutely kind of a parallel to leadership, really. You know, we all have a very specific gift. You know, we all get formed by experience, you know, depending on what that experience is. By, like you said, you know, I got a great mentor, changed my life. You know, it's not I went to a great kind of leadership class at Harvard Business School. It's like I received a great mentor. My experience led me from, you know, my family experience from Ethiopia made me think about diversity, made me think about kind of people who struggle. And, you know, and I've had those similar experiences. And that's where leadership really kind of takes place. So being in that environment really just opened my eyes and allowed me to liberate myself from the business school kind of way of thinking and finish that book, yeah.
And did you want to be a theologian or a priest at some point? Was that
I've always been drawn to being, since my 30s, working in some religious kind of aspect. And I thought about being a priest. I was going to study Masters for Divinity as a kind of a training in the church, but I chose not to. I thought I had many of the gifts, and I thought I had some of the gifts were lacking. And
yeah,
and I, you know, it's something about knowing yourself and applying yourself to the world in the best fit. And I'm not very good in institutions, and the Christian world and the churches are quite institutional. And I could see myself sort of getting myself into trouble. So I thought maybe I'm more of an edge. Maybe more of an edge leader and leading from the edge is probably a better place for me.
Yeah. Well, it's needed. I mean, but I can see that wholesomeness or whatever the depth, the sacredness, I guess, in that leadership book that I read, you know, shortly after that conference. I read that first, the first edition of it. I really, really was moved by it. I think that, you know, we should do more to bring, you know, to liberalize those texts. So it's to make it easier for people to understand, to kind of write a, if I may say so, like a popular version of it, I guess. You know.
Yeah, no, it's my plan. I've had that on the table for 5 years, and I'm hoping to start it this summer. And it's going to probably be called Eco-Leadership, a new leadership paradigm or something like that, to invite people to it. And it's going to be more, it's going to, just take out the main kind of themes and share them in a way which is very accessible. So that's part of my plan. Krish, listen, we're coming to the end. We could go on for a long time. This is a lovely, lovely conversation. As you may be aware, I ask my guests at the end of the show what they can offer the audience in terms of any thinking on how to live a good life or to create a good society. I wondered if you had any thoughts from your experience, which is an amazing experience, to share with our audience.
Thank you. Well, I can't say anything apart from give you a few generalizations. But number one would be, my number one thing is to invite somebody who's different from you to a meal or accept a meal. Almost the acceptance of an invitation is a bigger thing than hosting. Because the people I've had through my door, you know, like people who wouldn't have ever, you know, come to a home of someone like me. So just the more we can engage in those kinds of things over primal important things like eating or, you know, is really important. And I can't stress it enough, because I remember years ago, somebody phoning me up and said, you know, I hear you're the interfaith guy. And I go, oh, great. And they said, you know, I've got 500 rabbis and 500 imams, got 2 hours. Can you get them to love each other or something? And I said, no, but I suggest you, if all you've got is that, then have a big meal and make sure that, you know, that the needs of the other are attended. And secondly, so inviting people into people's homes is really the big thing. The second thing, I guess, is become aware of whether you have particularly to the people who do not have faith, I think, perhaps go out of your own comfort zones and your own paradigms and kind of see what it might be, try and look for what it might be like if you do have a faith and it does mean to you, and how you can engage with such a person in the task of making the world a better place.
That's lovely and helpful advice. Chris, it's been a real pleasure. Go well, keep up the good work, and I look forward to seeing you in London soon.
Looking forward to it.
Hi, this is Simon. Just a quick message to thank you all for listening this year to Edgy Ideas Podcast, and a really huge thanks to my guests who have appeared. We've had over 13,000 listens. We're in the top 10% of globally ranked podcasts. And we're going to take a summer break. July and August are a time for recuperation, for writing, and for regeneration. I hope you have a great summer. I'm really looking forward to being with you again in September. Go well. Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like further information about our coach and leadership training, or would like to join our advanced community of practice where we discuss edgy ideas and much, much more, please contact me, Simon@analyticnetwork.com.